This afternoon we are having a look at Majjhima Nikaya number 84, the Madhura Sutta, in the Gunda Grove. That's the only time that the Gunda Grove is mentioned, I believe. This particular sutta features Venerable Mahakatana, who was praised by the Buddha as being the foremost in those who were able to expound in detail what was first spoken by the Buddha in brief. And in such a capacity, there's a number of suttas in the canon which feature this ability of Mahakatana, where he gives some very profound, very interesting expositions of brief statements given by the Buddha. And this idea that you have these monks and nuns who are foremost in a particular category is something you find in the Anguttara Nikaya and its counterpart in the Ekottara Agama. It always strikes me as being a little bit unusual and perhaps slightly forced. I kind of feel that the Buddha may have made a couple of remarks along those lines and became greatly systematized after his death. I'm not sure that this particular category of being the foremost in one who's able to expound in detail what the Buddha taught in brief, I'm not sure if it would have been that significant enough to warrant a particular sort of prize at the annual Monk Academy Awards. And of course, according to the later theory of it, was that everybody had to make the aspiration to have that particular quality. Okay, so if you wanted to be the foremost disciple, you had to make the aspiration in your past life to be the foremost disciple and so on. Again, I'm not quite sure if anyone here feels that they feel the inspiration to aspire to be the foremost in those who explain in detail what was taught by the Buddha in brief. Does that sound like something that you'd immediately spring to mind? Anyway, this is how he's remembered by the tradition. And as such, Mahakatana of course, regarded and probably quite correctly as one of the founders of the Abhidhamma tradition, which of course that's basically what the Abhidhamma does. Now, this particular sutta is, interestingly enough, set in Mathura, sometimes spelt with a D and sometimes with a T, and is one of the very few early suttas which is set in this particular town. And Mathura is a very interesting town because it seemed to play very little or no role in early Buddhism, but became very important in later Buddhism. And so this particular sutta, even though on the surface it's a fairly simple sutta and might appear to be of somewhat limited interest, but nevertheless it is, I think, of historical interest in establishing what is perhaps the earliest or one of the earliest genuine points of connection between the Sasana and Mathura. So before going on to actually talk about this particular sutta, I might just talk about a little bit about Mathura and the link between Buddhism and Mathura, and what the importance of Mathura in the Buddhist tradition. Now, if we had the internet up, I'd show you a map. I don't believe I've saved the map locally, but the map would show you. Oh, here we go, ancient India map. There you go. Excellent. So here's the map of ancient India, and down here is the main area where the Buddha lived. Let's see if I can just enlarge that a bit. This is the main area where the Buddha lived around here. Nalanda, Rajagaha, Bodh Gaya, and then up here, here's the Vajjin country, Patna, the Vajjin country, over here, Kapilavastu, Savatthi, here, and then down as far as Benares or Kasi down here. So that's if you look at the suttas, maybe 95% or even more of all the suttas are given within that particular area. Okay? And so there's no doubt that that's where the Buddha spent the vast majority of his time, wandering around that particular area there. And then there's a few suttas where he goes further afield, and he goes to the southwest here as far as Avanti. Now this southwest, and this is called the Dakshinapata, this is the southern road, okay? Literally, this area is kind of difficult to pass, and so this the trade routes follow the way. You can see the towns are clustered down here, and to Avanti, and this is probably the limit to which the Buddha travelled in his lifetime, and the limit to which is really mentioned in the suttas. There's one slightly later sutta that mentions down here the Godavari River in this area down here. So that's the southern route. Now we then also have the northern route, which goes up here to the northwest, and then that leads up to, I'm not sure I can seem to be able to scroll, that leads up here to Kashmir, Gandhara, and then through there, through the passes to Persia in the west, and to Central Asia, and the Silk Road to the north and the northeast. Now Mathura is here. Okay, so Mathura is more or less halfway along the northern road between the Buddha's ancient realm, where the Buddha spent most of his time, and the Kashmir and Gandhara region. Interestingly enough, the king in the sutta that we're looking at is called Avantiputta, and I haven't had a chance to look him up in the dictionary proper names, but Avanti is the area down here on the southern road, and Avantiputta, the son of Avanti, so he's probably from the Avanti region. And it was very common in those days for the prince to marry out and to be brought up in a foreign realm. Here we have Mathura, and it's on the Yamuna River, and that being where I think it's where the Taj Mahal is. I think it's modern day Agra, if I'm not mistaken. So that's here, a little bit south of the Kurukshetra. So the Kurukshetra, modern Delhi region. This is where the Satipatthana Sutta and Mahanidana Sutta and some other suttas were spoken. So that region then would be the northwestern limit of how far the Buddha travelled in his life, as far as we know. So mainly he was around here, and then a little bit up here, and then a little bit down here on the southern road. And as Buddhism spread, it's in the years after the Buddha, and especially in the Ashokan years, it spread up further along those roads, so down here, then to Sri Lanka, and up here to Kashmir, of course, became a very strong centre of Buddhism in later years. So this is the sort of the historical significance of Mathura, as it became a major staging post and very central region between the old established regions of Buddhism, which is where King Ashoka's capital was, and then the areas of Kashmir and so on, which became the centre in later years. So I'll just read here from a few bits from John S. Strong, The Legend and Cult of Upagupta. And if you haven't read this book, then as Molly Meldrum would say, do yourself a favour. Fantastic work. Okay, quite early, perhaps even during the lifetime of the Buddha himself, missionary monks began to wander up the valleys of the Ganges and its tributaries, preaching, converting and establishing new communities of the faithful as they went. The city of Mathura on the Yamuna River may well have received their attention from the start. Now he goes on, according to a text that is certainly apocryphal, particular text appearing in various places, doesn't give the sources here. It appears in the Mulasarvasivara Vinaya. The Buddha himself is reputed to have visited Mathura. He arrived there on the day of a festival. The goddess of the city, who's this Yakini, worried that the Buddha's presence would detract from the celebrations in her honour, and she sought either to seduce him or to scare him away by appearing before him as a naked woman. The Buddha, however, merely declared that clothed females were unattractive, how much more so naked ones? Now, that's not the kind of thing that you say to a goddess and get away with it lightly, right? And you, if you look in mythology and so on, anyone who sees the goddess, especially if you see the naked goddess, and usually you get ripped to shreds or something like that, terrible. But anyway, the Buddha just makes this rather... It's from the Mulasarasivada Vinaya, but it seems to be quite a widespread kind of legend. Yeah, I'll go a little bit into the sources a bit later on. Yeah. Embarrassed, she went away, and the Buddha then commented to his disciples that Mathura was a dusty place, plagued by fierce dogs and demons, where there were too many women, the ground was uneven, alms were difficult to obtain, and the people, perhaps the monks, ate when it was still at night time. It was clear that at this point Mathura was, in the view of some Buddhists at least, a rather tough mission field and hardly the beacon of the faith that it eventually became. Okay, so that's just a summary of the story from the Mulasarasivada Vinaya. Now, I'll talk a little bit more about that in a minute, but just raise for you a bit of a problem, right? Now, imagine that say for example, if you're a Sri Lankan, right? And people come to visit your lovely island, and you say, what a wonderful Buddhist heritage there are, and look here. On the top of the Sri Pada mountain, there's the Buddha's footprint where he came and he blessed the country, and he said that the Dhamma would come and spread here and last for thousands of years, and so on and so on and so forth. And you'd be filled with wondrous pride and so on that the Buddha had blessed your land, right? Now, whether that happened or not doesn't matter, but you've got this belief which empowers you and blesses your land. Now, imagine if you're a poor citizen of Mathura, okay? What do you do? We say, well, the Buddha came here. He got confronted by this naked Yakini, and then he said that the place is dusty and full of dogs and monsters, and then left and said, you can't get any arms. That's the blessing that he gave to our city. Right? So, of course, you've got a bit of a problem here. Right? So this problem was addressed by the later traditions. And I'll just read a little bit of what happened, and I discussed it a bit in Sects and Sectarianism. Now, the interesting thing about this is that particular story I just mentioned, the earliest form of that legend is found in the Anguttara Nikaya. Okay? So Anguttara 5.220. The Buddha simply remarks that in Mathura, the roads are uneven, it is dusty, the dogs are fierce, the yuccas are predatory, and alms food is hard to get. Okay? So notice it doesn't say anything about there being too many women there. But it's still not a good rap. So that's all it gives you. It's just a sutta. It's called the Mathura Sutta. It's in the Anguttara Nikaya, and it says here that marks are these five disadvantages of Mathura. The roads are uneven, it's dusty, the dogs are fierce, the yuccas are going to eat you, and alms food is hard to get. Now again, it's not particularly auspicious, and not particularly encouraging for a centre which in later years became a kind of a central place for the growth of Buddhism. Right? So you can imagine that there was a need to adapt or show a different perspective on this particular event. So we've already seen that the Mulasarasivada Vinaya then draws that out by saying he was actually confronted by this Yakini who tried to seduce him out of fear that he would convert all her devotees. Okay, so here's a summary of the Mulasarasivada Vinaya here. The Buddha visited Mathura and was greeted by the Brahmin householders, although they were initially suspicious because it was said he did not pay proper respect to Brahmins. Okay? Now this is an interesting little motif here, because the sutta that we're going to read in the Majjhima Nikaya is precisely about this point, precisely about the relative respect and honour due to the four castes, yeah, and the positions of the four castes. So what seems to me is that this text, again this is the Mulasarvastivada Vinaya, is showing an awareness of that Majjhima Nikaya discourse, okay? it knows that that exists. Actually, that particular discourse is found in the Samyutta Agama, in their texts. So this is a kind of an allusion to that particular issue. Nevertheless, he taught a Brahmin called Nila Bhuti a lesson on the caste system, and they were all converted. That day was a festival day, and the Buddha was then challenged by the Yakini. And after this episode that he spoke of the five disadvantages as above. Okay. Then he told monks, don't stay in Mathura, and left to stay at the donkey monster forest. Okay. And Gardhaba being the word for donkey, and this having various connections and allusions with these various yakas around the place. The Brahmins of Mathura are anxious to feed the monks and secure their blessings, for they have been plagued by the child-eating yakas called Shara Vana and the Yakini Harika. Okay, the Indic forms of these first names, blah 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 blah. It's just a textual note on the names there. The ogres can't come and sit in while the Buddha is teaching the Dhamma, evidently intending to spoil the event. But the Buddha admonishes them and they are converted. The townsfolk built 2,500 monasteries, one for each of the 2,500 yakas who have been converted. So this is a typical conversion legend for early Buddhism, that when the Buddhist missionaries went into a new town or city or region, that they were a threat to the local yakas or the local nagas or whoever, of course being a coded way of saying that they were a threat to the local religious institutions who would have been worshipping these yakas and so on. And so, of course, there's basically two ways in religion that these kinds of conflicts are negotiated. Either you go in there with your swords blazing and kill all of the local deities, this being the popular route in Greek and often Hebrew mythology and so on, or in Indian mythology you convert them to your own system. So of course, in the Greek mythology, they were usually when Zeus and Apollo and his mates come in. If there's a local god, they'll usually kill them, and if they're a local goddess, they'll usually rape them. And this being the way that they dominated the local cults. Buddhist tradition is a bit more gentle, a lot more gentle, and rather than getting too violent about it, there may be a bit of a. Sometimes there's like a psychic power display. It's like who's got the best psychic powers. So this happens in some places. In some places there's a bit of a kind of a verbal stoush, as we've seen here. And in some places, but in the end of the day, the yakas and the yakinis are converted by the Buddha's teachings. And now once that happens, then they set up shrines for the yakas and yakinis in the monasteries. So they build monasteries and they put shrines for the yakas and yakinis in the monasteries where they continue to receive the offerings of the laity. Okay? So this is obviously an encoded way of depicting a long and slow process. But if you go to any Buddhist temple in Asia and so on today, you'll find that that's still the case, that there are still shrines to the local spirits of the land, to the local yakas or nagas and so on, and these are still found within the temple grounds, and the people will still come up and put a little offering of rice in front of them and so on and so forth. So what we're seeing here is the continuation of that same tradition, which we see some early examples of it here. And so now with this much more complete version of the story, we can now see how that original small sutta has now been completely adopted within a Buddhist conversion narrative, okay? So this is where you can see things in from two different perspectives. If you look at it from a text-critical perspective, right, you lay the suttas out from early, middle and later, and you see, well, the actual authentic Buddhist sutta on that was simply the Buddha dissing Mathura because of its horrible, dusty roads and you couldn't get any alms and the dogs are going to bite you. Now, whether the Buddha said that or not, but that's the earliest text that we've got. And then there's got a gradual adoption of it until finally all the yakas and so on who are responsible for all the nasty things have now been converted, and of course becomes a wonderful centre for the Dhamma, and it's very blessed, and thousands of monasteries there and so on and so forth. So depending on how you want to read the text, gives you a very different depiction on how you perceive Mathura. And I think it doesn't take much speculation to know how the good citizens of Mathura would have preferred to read the thing in their own way. So this is very interesting little evolution to show some of the ways that Buddhism became adopted in these places. Now, after the life of the Buddha, Mathura featured in the Second Council. Shanavasin was one of the elders at the Second Council, so now 100 years after the Buddha, and Shanavasin established the monastery Urumunda Monastery, which became the most famous forest meditation monastery in India, and that the Mataran lineage became very central to the lineage claims and the sense of identity for several of the northern schools, including the Sarvastri Garden schools, but also the Mahasanghikas. By the time that we have concrete epigraphical evidence from Mathura is about the 1st century AD, and there are various inscriptions from Buddhist schools in Mathura, and they refer both to the Sarvastivadins and to the Mahasanghikas, and it seems that the Puglavadins also had a presence there, and there were also Jains and Hindus there at that time, so it was a very diverse and thriving religious centre. Okay. So the idea here is that with the Mataran community at the time of the Buddha was kind of on the borders, and only later became very central to a sense of Buddhist identity. One of the arguments that I develop in Sects and Sectarianism, following the German scholar Fravelner, is to argue that the Mula Sarvastivadin school was originally centred in Mathura. So this is historically important because that's the Vinaya school of the lineage of the Tibetans. And Tibetan Vinaya lineage traces its history back to the Mula Sarvastivadins. So it seems that this is where they come from. And so in reading the Mathura Sutta, we're actually looking at possibly one of the earliest texts that's attributed to that school of the that later evolved into what we know today as the Mula Sarvastivadins. Now this particular text, just to come back to our actual text, it says, as I heard, on one occasion the Venerable Mahakachana was staying in Mathura in the Gundavana. Interestingly enough, it's one of the fairly rare suttas that doesn't speak of the Buddha being alive when the sutta is given, okay, in the introduction. Was it Kachana? I think it was, yeah. He was staying in Avanti at the time, yeah.
Right, so was
something like that, yeah. Maybe it's, yeah, interesting whether there's a connection. I hadn't thought of that. Yeah, it could be. Yeah. So in the introduction there's no reference to the Buddha being alive, and in the final paragraphs of the sutta we find out that the Buddha has actually passed away when this sutta is spoken. Okay, so this one probably given shortly after the Parinibbana, and thus it would seem likely included in the canon after the First Council. It would seem logical. Again, that kind of emphasizing the fact that, well, this is almost like a first spread of Buddhism after the Buddha's own failure to try to spread Buddhism there and running out of the place chased by the dogs, it sounds like. But then this is like an early example of the ways that the Buddhist missionary effort spread in those areas. Yeah?
Mm-hmm.
No. Absolutely, yeah. Well, you can't always believe everything that you're taught, can you? Yeah. The word evametsu, tongue, is commonly said to be the word spoken by Ananda at the first council, but there's actually places in the Pali that use that phrase as an idiom, and what it means as an idiom is I wasn't there, but this is what I was told about it.
Phrase can only be used by the noble Ananda when he, if you recollect the teaching that the Buddha actually, because it's a thing when he's not there, or
again, that's what the tradition says, but the idiom actually means I wasn't there, but this is what I was told about it. Mm. Okay, so it couldn't have been spoken by Ananda because he was actually there. Yeah?
Mm. But he was not there all the time, but
he was there a lot of the time.
Yeah.
Yeah.
He asked
that the Buddha repeats to him. That's right. In those cases, there's a different idiom that's used in Pali, which is Sammukame Bhagavato Sutang Sammukam Pahigahitam, which means I've heard this spoken to me directly by the Buddha himself. Okay? And that idiom is found in some places in the canon, and Ananda uses it when he wants to emphasize that he's heard something from the Buddha himself, and then he's repeating that. So it's quite distinct. And when you say evametsu tongue, it means that the listener understands by that you were not there. Okay? Because if you had said evametsu tongue, they would understand, oh, this is hearsay. So, for example, it's given in a discourse where I think it's Aniruddha speaks to somebody about the gods and the devas. Okay? The devas did this and so on and so forth. And then the person says, it strikes me that Venerable Aniruddha didn't say evametsu tongue. So that means that he must have been there himself. Yeah? So, you know, yeah? So you can understand from that. The very fact that he uses evametsu tongue tells you that editorial voice is telling you. What it wants you to know is that the editor, the voice that you're hearing, was not present at the actual, didn't actually hear that from the Buddha himself. So this is that, but that idiom to become misunderstood in later years.
Yeah. Interesting that an advice that was designed to maintain accuracy in epistemology is turning out to be the opposite.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. So, okay. Yeah?
What's the little circular line?
Oh, the little flibble flobble underneath the thingies. That's a little. That's a little. How do I describe it? Flibble flobble is probably the best word, which was put into these texts by the editors of the Thai World Tripitaka Association. And what it does is it marks those consonant clusters which are usually pronounced in Thailand by inserting an inherent vowel between them. So, for example, here is ayasmata, and in Thailand they would say ayasamata. And this is viti sa retwa, and so it would be in Thai pronounced viti sa retawa, and so on. And so they've marked all of these. The basic reason, the ideological reason, is because the people who put this together wanted to produce a Roman script Tripitaka. And one of the reasons why they do that is because they don't like the fact that Thais don't pronounce Pali properly. So they're trying to educate them in how you're actually supposed to pronounce Pali. You don't actually, you're not in when you read these in Thai, you're not forced to insert these extra vowels. But it's just if it was written in Thai, you would put the extra vowel in. And so they assume that when they're writing Pali, that it sort of creeps in as well. So this is really that attempt to improve the doom to failure, of course. But a kind of noble attempt. I think they've taken them out now, yeah, which is good. I mean, it's only really useful in Thailand. This is this text I copied when they first put their website up. So I don't think they have them anymore. And you can't do anything with them because they're not like a regular character. So you can't take them out or anything, and they move places, like that's not in the right place. It actually should be between the T and V. So it would get a bit annoying. Okay. Where are we? And Matara, Kachayana. We've done that. Okay, let's go. Oh, no, hang on, that's not good. That's right, that's what I'm doing. Right, no, other one. Okay, so this is Veronalio's essay on it, and this, just to remark that it has the parallel not found in the Madhyama Agama, but found in the Sanyukta Agama of the Sarvasivadin canon. On occasion, Venerable Mahakachana was living at Madhura at the Gunda Grove. King Avantiputta of Madhura heard. The recluse Kachana is living at Madhura in the Gunda Grove. Now, a good report of Master Kachana has been spread to this effect. His wise, discerning, sagacious, learned, articulate, and perspicacious Kraki Pandito Vyato Medhavi Bahusuto Chittakati. Chittakati literally means a beautiful or diverse speaker, an eloquent speaker. And Kalyana Patibhano has a similar meaning, also means Patibhano is one's ability to speak speak the Dhamma, and so one of beautiful inspiration, a beautiful eloquence. And he is aged or senior, and he is an arahant. It's good to see such arahants. So then King Avantiputta of Madhura had a number of state carriages made ready, and mounting a state carriage, he drove out from Madhura with the full pomp of royalty in order to see the Venerable Mahakachana. He went as far as the road was passable for carriages, and then he got down from his carriage and went forward on foot to the Venerable Mahakachana. He exchanged greetings with him, and when this courteous and amiable talk was finished, he sat down at one side and said, "Master Kachana, the Brahmins say this," and using a word, the Bho is a term of address commonly used by the Brahmins. "Brahmins are the highest caste. Those of any other caste are inferior. Brahmins are the fairest caste. Those of any other caste are dark. Only Brahmins are purified, not non-Brahmins. Brahmins alone are the sons of Brahma, the offspring of Brahma, born of Brahma's mouth, born of Brahma, created by Brahma, heirs of Brahma." What does Master Kachana say about that? Right. So, as we noted before in the Mudasarasivada Vinaya, that the Brahmins didn't like the Buddha because he didn't speak in praise of the Brahmins. So, possibly derived from this text. So, here's the word for caste that we're using here is Varna in Pali, or spelled Varna in Sanskrit. And so, Varna literally meaning a colour. So the notion of colour is also apparent here when it says that the Brahmins are the white caste, Sukhavarno, and the other castes are black. So it's often conjectured or wondered whether or to what degree there's a racial connotation here. Are we just dealing with the different stratification and of society? Or are we dealing with actual racial differences? And it's often postulated that the Brahmin caste is descended or related to the Aryans who moved into India, perhaps 2000 BC, and that this is somehow related to this. And if you go to northern India, you'll find that actually India is incredibly ethnically diverse. You kind of wander down the street and there's people with all kinds of different appearances there. But typically in northern India, people tend to be lighter skinned, and southern India they tend to be darker skinned. And so it's often wondered whether this corresponds to this kind of racial division, where the Aryans have moved into the north and displaced the indigenous Indians who've moved into the south. And that theory was more or less accepted for quite a while, originally proposed by Max Müller in the 19th century, and in recent years has come under increasing scrutiny. It's rejected by almost all the Indian scholars, and the Westerners have more qualified but still questioning it. Recent research seems to show that that skin colour is actually related to your distance from the equator, and that people, when they move into areas where there's more sun, develop darker skin, which is fairly obvious, and that this happens relatively quickly, so probably over a few hundred or perhaps a few thousand years. All around the world there's a similar kind of distribution in all different parts of the world, where people who are living closer to the equator have darker skin and those further away have lighter skin. So it seems that's a sufficient explanation for the distribution of skin colours in India. And again, recent genetic research seems to show that there's very little genetic difference between the castes in India, and that insofar as there is any distinction, then it seems more likely that if there were any Aryan invaders or incursion into India, that it was primarily a cultural movement, and that there may have been some movement of the Aryans into the higher castes, but it's still not kind of a sort of major distinction, racial distinction there.
What about within Europe, we have this kind of
You still see that certainly in Thailand as well, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, you see the Thai women when they're working always completely covered from the sun. Yeah. And there's a very strong racial distinction in Thailand, or skin colour distinction. If you go into the, I mean, I was quite stunned actually, because I wasn't used to seeing that in Australia, mainly I guess because all the Aborigines are kept too far away from sight, you don't even notice it. But in Thailand, you definitely saw that people working in the fields were very dark skinned, and if you went into town and go to the bank or the department store, and then you got these very, very light skinned Chinese looking people. Yeah. So it's still, you know, not explicit, but there's still that kind of that hint is still there. Yeah. And partly it's due, as you say, to the just the exposure to the sun, but also partly, you know, the question is then, is it also partly to do the maintenance of these kind of racial boundaries?
Yeah. It's also a little different. They have this kind of hair that they are just blonde and direct people,
yeah,
who are higher than the other people.
Yeah.
It's very common, it's all in the world.
And one of the problems is that he says he kanho anyo wano, the other ones are dark. Pali word kanha, the Sanskrit pronunciation of that is Krishna, and of course one of the most famous Hindu gods is Krishna, who's always depicted as having blue skin, which being a kind of a painterly kind of convention, showing that he's actually remembered as having black skin or dark skin. So him being kanha or Krishna, being a culture hero of obviously dark complexion, and it's being a little bit embarrassing for some of the modern Hindus. And notice here the use of the word hina. Manova seto anyo, the Brahmins are the high, the best caste, and the other castes are hina or low. And so this, of course, being the same hina as in hinayana, meaning the low vehicle, small vehicle. So the idea that the Brahmins were born of the mouth of Brahma is relating back to some of the old Vedic mythology about the different castes being born from different parts of the Brahma's body, and that the lower castes were born from the Brahma's feet, for example. Then Kachana's reply, Gahuso yeva koe so maharaja lokasmi. So this is just a saying in the world, a gosa in the world. So the word ghosa here being the same word as buddha ghosa, like a voice or something like that. Interestingly enough, in Thailand, I'm not sure about other countries, but ghosa is the word that's used for an advertisement. Okay, so an ad, it's like an ad or it's propaganda in the world. There is a way, can we understand how this statement of the Brahmins is just a saying in the world, or just propaganda? What do you think, great king? If a noble prospers in wealth, grain, silver or gold, that's a khatiya, will there be khatiyas who rise before him and retire after him, who are eager to serve him, who seek to please him and speak sweetly to him? And will there also be Brahmins, merchants and workers who do likewise? There will be, Master Kachana. What do you think, great king? If a Brahmin prospers in wealth, grain, silver and gold, or if a merchant prospers, or even if a worker, a suddha, prospers in wealth, grain, silver and gold, will there be workers who rise before him and retire after him, who are eager to serve him, who seek to please him and speak sweetly to him? And will there also be nobles, Brahmins and merchants who do likewise? There will be, Master Kachana. What do you think? Great king, if that's so, then are these forecasts all the same, or are they not, or how does it appear to you in this case? Surely then all these forecasts are the same, there's no difference between them at all that I see. And then that's the way, great king, where can we understand how that statement of the Brahmins is just worldly propaganda? Now, have a look at Analia's comments on that. Whereas the Pali mentions the ordinary forecasts, Brahmins, warriors, merchants and workers. The Sanyukta Agama speaks of Brahmins, warriors and two types of householders. It goes in to discuss that somewhere there. Several other discourses in the Sanyukta Agama, however, have the standard listing of all four castes. It includes the merchants and workers. Hence the present reference might be a confusion of the four castes with the four types of wise men, blah, or else confusion of the four castes with the three great types of families. In fact, the Madhura's suggestion that all four castes were able to reach a high social position in ancient India could be called into question. It seems improbable, according to Vembalanalaya, that this is being expanded a bit, couldn't it? It seems improbable that a member of the worker caste could ascend within the ancient Indian social system to such an extent that members of all castes will serve him. From a historical perspective, while the other three castes were occupational divisions among the Aryan invaders, the conquered aborigines came to make up the worker caste and were looked down upon and kept subdued by the other three castes. That is, I think, an overly simplistic and probably not very accurate summary of the situation, as I just described a bit earlier. There's little to no evidence, I think, that the aborigines came to make up the worker caste. In fact, the aboriginal or indigenous population probably, well, there certainly remained indigenous peoples who were outside of the caste system altogether. Though some degree of social fluctuation may well have been possible between the three higher castes in ancient India, it would seem improbable that members of the fourth caste were able to reach a social position allowing them to have members of the other three castes at their command. Nevertheless, the present context is clearly concerned with the four castes, as the whole discourse takes its occasion from claims to caste superiority. As the Pali statement about becoming wealthy is formulated as a hypothetical suggestion to apply this possibility to the worker caste may not have been intended as an accurate reflection of ancient Indian social mobility. I don't really agree with Analia's comments here. I think that he's putting the cart before the horse, and that the very point of this sutta is to show exactly the point that there was a degree of flexibility in the way that the castes were treated, and we shouldn't assume a priori that the castes weren't flexible, the caste position wasn't flexible, therefore the sutta must be wrong, since all we have to show that the caste situation was rigid is propaganda texts from the Hindus, basically, and which were, moreover, much later, from a much later date than the Pali canon. So this is one thing that is fairly standard, actually, within the Pali canon and within texts of this time, that the caste system was less rigid and stratified than it became in later years. And so I think this is in harmony with the general tendency of the Indian society at that time. They all intersect, but I think he's kind of erring on the side of saying that the caste system is determining it. Yeah. I mean, it's interesting. For example, I think it mentions further here Chandragupta, first Mauryan king, who's like 100 years after the Buddha, in the time of the Second Council, and he was of a low birth according to all the traditions, and ascended. It was basically a brigand in the border regions who sort of through his cunning and so on ascended to the kingship of all of India. There's also a question of not to reify our sources, because most of our knowledge about ancient Indian society is derived from texts and scriptures, and those texts and scriptures are prescriptive. They're trying to create something in a certain particular way. They're not just an objective record of those things. So just as the Buddhist text here is concerned to overturn the caste system and to sort of de-emphasize the caste system, and the Brahmanical texts are on the opposite side trying to emphasize that. And so the Brahmanical texts are, of course, concerned to create an idea of an ideal social structure where everyone has their nice, neat little place, which is determined by the caste system. And that neat picture has probably, of course, never actually existed in society, but was an ongoing and always changing situation. It's also true that that there was the caste system in ancient India was by nowhere near as developed then as it became in later years. And these days, you know, you have this whole system in India where every person is a particular caste, which is a particular job that they're given. They're a flower collector or a rubbish collector or a woodworker or something. And you don't find anything like that in the Buddha's time. That system, that very detailed caste system, only evolved much later.
I didn't actually know that. I mean, I didn't see the relation of caste nor flexibility, and for me it just meant what he was trying to say is that within every caste there's a big variability, and within every I didn't even think of it as caste, just you know what he said, you know, the hospital, the workers, the merchants, and within every group there's a big variation.
Yeah.
And so you can be a rich person in that group and a poor person in that group, and you draw much more parallel lines in between the levels of each of the group rather than within the group. So that what he was trying to tell him, that the fact that the way they organize, the Brahmins organize the society, is not necessarily how can they proceed.
Yeah.
And that was like my feeling. Neither that nor there. Like, it might be that it was very structured in the red line, that you weren't so caste and you can't move from one to the other. But then within that, there's a new way where you can position yourself.
Yeah.
And it will be the same for them, so you can look at it in different ways.
Yeah, yeah. And there's just as we're shown here, an example of a low caste person is very successful.
Yeah.
There's also plenty of examples of Brahmins who live very kind of low and humble lives, and maybe just farmers and all kinds of things.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, so it's not saying that you can swap from one caste to the other.
Yeah.
Although, again, there's a question of how much that actually happened as well. So. Something like that, yeah. Yeah, they were like the Knights of the Round Table or something like that. Yeah. Okay, the Samyutta Agama discourse differs in this respect in that it doesn't talk about the becoming a wealthy person, but instead speaks of becoming a king. And then as a result of that, the Chinese version, Samyutta Agama, envisages the possibility that Brahmins and householders become kings. Yet at the Buddha's time, kingship appears to have been the sole domain of the warrior caste and not been open to Brahmins and householders in general. It seems to hold true until the time of the first Mauryan king, Chandragupta, who, according to some sources, was of low birth. The Samyutta Agama's version's suggestion that Brahmins and householders become kings recurs in the Chinese Mahasangika and Sarvasivada Vinayas and in the Divya Vadana. These presentations may reflect the influence of later historical developments. Okay, so again, it's just being a suggestion that if it's true that earlier and in the Buddha's time only the Kshatriyas would become the kings, and then if that convention was called into question by Chandragupta, then it's possible that this suggestion, together with these other texts, which are certainly later, then may be an indication that the text is late and post Ashokan. Okay, so Chandragupta being King Ashoka's grandfather. Again, a somewhat uncertain argument here, but certainly there's no doubt that these Vinayas, Mahasangika, Sarvastivada Vinayas, and the Divya Vadana, being a biography of King Ashoka, these are later texts. Again, I'm not 100% convinced by that. It's simply the case that we don't have that many realistic historical records of kings, of very many Indian kings before this time. And so I think it's difficult to generalise and say that it really was only the Kshatriyas who became kings, although certainly that was the normal situation.
The clean line of the case system, it just seems unrealistic given the messiness of reality. You know, it's like, you know, kings have illegitimate sons.
Oh yeah, it happens all the time. Yeah.
Just no kind of average human mind.
Absolutely, yeah. And so all of these things are cultural constructs which are trying to tidy these things up. So it's always very dubious to take that cultural construct as actually representing the reality. Cultural construct represents the attempt to categorise and make the structure of the society. Yeah. But yeah, and there's plenty of, I mean, this is one of the standard myths, and I mean, according to Levi-Strauss's analysis of mythology and so on, like one of the basic origin of logic was in development of kinship systems. And so this is why kinship systems have a great importance from anthropology, because you always have a certain, basically you always have to develop this thing of saying someone is a kin or is not a kin, or someone is, in particular, somebody is a potential partner or is not a potential partner, right? So, for example, a sister is not a potential wife, but then maybe a cousin is, or maybe a second cousin is, or something like that. So that all the different kinship systems of the world have to draw those boundaries. And so this is where you get the either-or thing emerging. So you have to say, either I can get married to this person, or I can't. Yeah, and of course, that is never clear cut, because when issues of paternity and all of these things are never clear. So this is why you actually get very complex systems of logic working up through kinship systems. And according to Levi-Strauss, this is perhaps one of the very places where the idea of logic and the law of the excluded middle and so on actually kind of arose in human history. And Alia gives a quote here which is a little bit interesting. The Sarvastivada Vinaya defines kings by not only listing Brahmins and householders but also women as potential candidates. If a Brahmin, a householder or a woman were given the office of king, they are also reckoned as become king by sprinkling water on the head. Then this definition also occurs in the Divya Vadana from a similar sectarian affiliation, also Sarvastivada or Mula Sarvastivada. Striyapi, Brahmanopi, Vaishyopi, Shudropi, Rajyabhisheka, Nabhishik Sakto Bhavati Raja. It's basically the same situation. And here's Stri being the word for a woman. This is surprising, as it must have been impossible for a woman to become a king in ancient India, e.g. the Mahavastu in Sena. Nowhere females are kings, everywhere males are kings. And again, I find Nadia is kind of surprisingly, I think it's a surprisingly naive reading of the sources. The reality is that you've got some sources that say a woman can be king and some sources that say a woman can't be king. And you can't conclude from that that it's impossible. It must have been impossible for a woman to become king. Clearly, some people thought that, some ancient Indians thought that it was possible. There were, yeah. So you do find that situation. Certainly, at the very least, there's temporary rulers. Mm-hmm. So, this is the Abhisheka is the actual consecration of rulership. So this is the head sprinkling ceremony, the head anointed ceremony. So that's what actually means you're the king. You're not just a Raja could be a ruler, or a Rajini would be the queen. So somebody might be a regent or a queen or something like that, which is a different thing. But the actual head anointed king is like you're the man. Yeah. Obviously, it's an ancient custom. I'm not sure what the origins of it are. Yeah, it's referred to. Right. So head anointed king, but it's still done today. Like the king of Thailand, the head anointed Raja king. Yeah. So,
not sure about translating, but in a certain sense, for people who know it, in the truth of reality, it reminds me of that Buddhist saying that says, 2,500 years of Buddhist history, Buddhism has gone a long time without a single drop of blood being shed.
Right.
Like, you know, represents a tendency of the mind to just want to simplify things and move along with it too.
Yeah. Okay, so Katayana goes on with the analysis, and remembering that his particular skill that is expounding in detail what the Buddha spoke in brief. So don't expect to have a nice short little sutta, right? He could have said in answer to the question that this is rubbish. This is just an ancient Brahmanical myth, and actually people should be valued according to their own inequalities and what they do and how they live, rather than what caste they're born into. And he could have knocked it off in a sentence or two, but. Since he's giving it in detail, we have more than that. So he started out, in a sense, following a method which the Buddha used. He started out with quite a worldly example, which is something which the king could have easily identified with. The first example is about wealth and about whether people are going to bow to you and so on. So it's easy for the king to identify with that. He's not introducing any particular spiritual ideas, and the Buddha used exactly the same method in, for example, the Samanyapala Sutta, Digha 2, giving examples to King Ajatasattu, and starting out with a very similar kind of technique. Now he moves on to a more spiritual or ethical dimension. So what do you think, great king? Suppose a noble Kshatriya were to kill living beings, take what is not given, misconduct himself in sensual pleasures, speak falsely, speak maliciously, speak harshly, gossip, be covetous, have a mind of ill will, and, as well as all of those things, hold wrong views. On the dissolution of the body after death, would he reappear in a state of deprivation, in an unhappy destiny, in perdition, even in hell, or not? Or how does it appear to you in this case? If a noble were such, he would be likely to reappear in a state of deprivation, unhappy destiny, in perdition, even in hell. This is how it appears to me in this case, and thus have I heard from the Arahants. Interesting. which Arahants been listening to, Arahant being a conventional term in those days, not necessarily meaning Buddhist Arahants. But this is, of course, the 10 pathways of wholesome or unwholesome, in this case, action, akusala kamapata, being a very common idiom and one which you should all know. And I'll just sort of put it in a list here to make it easier to identify them. And so here's the first three correspond to the first three of the five precepts: killing living beings, taking what is not given, and misconducting sensual pleasures, adultery essentially. And then the next four being the four kinds of wrong speech, false speech, divisive speech, rough or abusive speech, and meaningless gossip. And then finally the three kinds of misconduct by means of body, four kinds of misconduct by means of speech, and three kinds of misconduct by the mind, abhijja, vyapanna, citta. These are basically strong forms of greed and anger. So abhijja is described literally as covetousness and like jealousy. Vyapanna is a mind of hatred and anger and so on. And of course, micchaditti is the wrong views. And so these corresponding to greed, hatred, and delusion, like strong forms of greed, hatred, and delusion. And so then after death, then you go to hell. And of course, this being a very common idiom. And of course, sometimes it being said that the notion of heaven and hell is purely a psychological one. And obviously, there are psychological dimensions to it, but this is a very common idiom, kayasa beheda, with the breaking up of the body, paramarana, after death, and clearly the text is referring to an after death, afterlife destiny, rather than merely a psychological state. A standard idiom. Notice that how this is introduced in the dialogue, that it's more or less the katana is not, in a sense, not really teaching these dhammas to the king, but he's assuming that the king will already recognize that these are good or bad things to do. So it's assuming that there's a common set of values. So the same question, as well as for a katiya, is then asked for a brahmin and a Vesa and a Sudra, a worker, and of course given the same answer. And so these, what do you think? Are these four vanas sama sama honti nova? Are they sama? Are they the same? Are they exactly the same? Sama sama honti nova or not? Certainly, these four castes are just the same. Sama sama. And then the next one reverses that. If you abstain from killing living beings, abstain from taking what is not given, and so on and so forth, whether you're a Kshatriya, Brahman, Vaisya, or Sudra, then in any case you would go to heaven. And this is how it appears to me in this case, says the king, and thus have I heard from the Arahants. So this is another example. So this is the second example. And then Kachana goes on to give a third example. Suppose a noble were to break into houses, sandhingva tindeya, sandhi literally meaning a connection, and the sandhi being a commonly used word for a window being a point of connection between the inner and the outer. It's just like, it's a kind of interesting usage, but sandhi is also a grammatical term, and it's used for the way that the Indic languages will combine different elements to form long words and compounds is the sandhi. But here, if you break the sandhi, literally if you cut the connection, is a literal translation of it. But translated by Bhikkhu Bodhi in accordance with the meaning is to break into houses. If you were to break into houses, plunder wealth, commit banditry, ekagarikam. Interesting. And ambush, ekagarikam. Oh, I'm not quite sure what that means here. To commit banditry is the translation. The Pali word is ekagarikam vakariya. Eka is one. Agara is like a house. One house. If you were one house-ish, kareya, if you were to do one house-ishness, full translation. Not quite sure how you get banditry out of there, but must be an idiom of some sort. Or if you were to paribanthevaditeya, if you were to be a highway robber, or to seduce another's wife, paradaranagateya. And if your men arrested him and produced him, saying, "Sire, this is the culprit, command what punishment for him you wish, how would you treat him?" Alright, so all of these things regarded as being crimes, including adultery. Well, we would have him, what would he do? What would the king do? The king would have him, I would have him executed, gadeyama, or I would have him fined, japeyama, or I would have him exiled, pabajeyama. So notice the same word for exile is the same word that we use for going forth. Interesting. Or I would do with him as he deserves, something or other, yatapachayang. Why is that? Because he's lost his former status of a noble and is simply reckoned as a robber. Choro tueva sankhyam gachate. What do you think, great king? And similarly, if a Brahmin, a merchant, or a Vaisya or a Sudra was to do the same thing, then he would be treated in the same way. Okay, and then the final one. What do you think, great king? Suppose a noble or a Brahmin or a Vaisya or a Sudra were to shave off their hair and beard, put on the yellow robe, and go forth from the home life into homelessness, were to abstain from killing living beings, from taking what is not given, from false speech, refraining from eating at night, eating only in one part of the day, and were celibate, virtuous, of good character. How would you treat them? We would pay homage to them, Master Kachana. We would rise up for them, invite them to be seated. We would invite them to accept robes, arms, food, resting place, and medicinal requisites. Or we would arrange for him lawful guarding, defense, and protection. Because he has, why is that? Because he's lost his former status as a noble, as a Brahmin, as a Vaisya, or a Sudra, and is simply reckoned as a recluse, as a samana. Samano dweva sankhyam gacchati. And this being very similar to the passage in the Samanyapala Sutta with the Buddha talking to Ajatasattu.
This passage is idiomatic. It's interesting because it cuts against what we're explaining about as the reality of the holy life. This idiomatic passage gives the impression that you put on the robes and immediately you're holy and immediately deserving of respect. Whereas the reality of the situation is just when you put on the robes, you're still pretty much a lay person, you put on the robes and retraining.
Yeah, well, this is that whole thing of you know, you've adopted a particular social intention in a way. But it obviously doesn't. And that's the convention, you know, the king is going to act in that way simply because you've put the robes on and so on. And refers basically only to your sila, if you're of good character as a monk, not referring to necessarily development of inner qualities, your brahmachari, your silava, kalyana dhamma. Yeah. So this is kind of relating to that whole kind of issue of the projection and the images of things. And but also I find this very fascinating how you find this all these parallels, these inverse parallels, if you like, between the samana and the lowest of the low, like the thief or the bandit or something like that. And you find these parallels very strongly. I mean, we've already seen that's the same word. Pabajaya is to expel someone, to exile someone, is the same word as to go forth. And then in both cases, both the summoner and the thief are in a way outside of the normal social structures. And the summoner is in a sense lifted above them, while the thief is below them. And this kind of duality is exploited quite a lot in Indian literature. For example, you find other places where there's a similar duality between a monk and a prostitute. And there's Indian dramas and literature and so on which sort of revolve around this kind of dualism of the prostitute who's in a sense also outside of the social norms, and the monk who's outside in a different way. And so of course this being the standard Buddhist attitude, that somebody who's entered the Sangha has left the caste system, being a political issue these days, obviously in much of or most of the Siang Nikaya in Sri Lanka, they do ordain according to caste, so you certainly don't leave your caste behind when you ordain.
Isn't that mostly the case with
all Siamese people? That's right, and that was the distinction between the Samana movement and the Brahmin ascetics, mm-hmm. Because they were still ordaining according to caste. So there was this whole countercurrent to this whole Brahmanical thing. I mean, that's what you're seeing here, is this contesting of this idea, and the king himself is a non-committal attitude towards it. You know, and this is why there's this assumptions, which I, again, why I'm a little bit uncomfortable with some of Analio's ideas there, because I think even he. Who has a very good historical grasp of these things, but he's still kind of almost assuming this kind of background assumption. Whereas you see, what's the king's attitude? The king's attitude is, well, this is what the Brahmins say. Well, what do you reckon about it? You know, so he's not a subject to that propaganda. You know, he's merely heard it and wants to ask about it. You know? Yeah. Well, not. No, I mean, it had already been there for at least 1,000 years in India. So, but, you know.
Like, in our current context, is, some of the would have just started in Australia.
Yeah.
To think about how they started, they would have just grown up in India. Basically, for a start, somebody's just got to walk out and just do it and be good at it and get respect and others will do it as well.
This lady who's here today, Nola, she walked 2,500 kilometres in northern Queensland with two donkeys.
Where did she walk?
She had cooked down or something to... I can't remember if she mentioned the number of times.
Why did she do
that? Family problems, you know. Whatever. You know, there was a time in her life she wanted to do it. Clear her head. She said it was the main problem was that there was like 1,000 kilometres when there wasn't any water. Well, she had to find farmers and ask for their help, which then became a problem, because then she had to talk to them. And she talked to farmers from northern outback northern Queensland. Yeah. Sorry. Well, they were just kind of discussing it with her, but they would tend to have slightly different kind of attitudes than she might have. Like they would be saying things like, "Oh, you don't go out there, you know, the abos will get you," and these kinds of things. So, you know, it was all quite. indigenous persons, as we say today. So, they had quite different attitudes. So she's saying that was kind of the unexpected thing she had to learn. She thought she'd have to struggle with nature and the environment and that, but it's actually dealing with the people was the hard thing. You know, even out there in the most remote part of like back Australia.
So going back to the Pandu religion before, were you saying that you don't think the hospital is actually that
well, it was there, but it was not necessarily as rigid and as defined and as unquestioned as it's often assumed to be, and this kind of text, which is questioning it, the very fact that this exists tells us that there was an ongoing dialogue about that, and that there always has been. Yeah. I mean, basically the caste system is, and as it says elsewhere in the Buddhist text, is basically, you know, the Brahmins giving everybody else the raw deal and asking them to accept it, you know, based on their own kind of intellectual and spiritual prestige. There would have always been voices questioning and challenging that. Yeah. And you find that within the Brahmin scriptures themselves. It's not just a Buddhist thing. Okay. So again, the great king would look after all of the summoners, no matter what caste they came from. And then at the end of it, King of Antiputta said, "Magnificent, Master Kachana, magnificent, Master Kachana has made the Dhamma clear in many ways. As though he were turning upright what had been overthrown, revealing what was hidden, showing the way to one who is lost, or holding up a lamp in the dark for those with eyesight to see forms. I go to Master Kachana for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today forth, let Master Kachana remember me as a lay follower who has gone to him for refuge for life." So he's going to refuge to Mahakachana. And the Buddha says, Master Kachana says, "Do not go to me for refuge, great king. Ma ko mang tuang maharaja saranagamasi. Go for refuge to that same blessed one to whom I have gone for refuge." And then the king says, "Where is he living now, Master Kachana, that blessed one accomplished and fully enlightened? That blessed one accomplished and fully enlightened has attained to Nibbana, great king." Then the king replied, "If we'd heard the Blessed One was within 10 leagues, we would go 10 leagues to see him. If we heard that he was within 20 leagues, 30 leagues, 40, 50, 100 leagues, we would go 100 leagues in order to see that Blessed One." It's nearly as far as that other journey. 100 leagues is about 1500 k's. "But since that Blessed One has attained to final Nibbana, we go to that Blessed One for refuge and to the Dhamma and to the Sangha of Bhikkhus. From today, let Master Kachana remember me as a lay follower who has gone for refuge for life." So this being the usual formula for going for refuge used by lay people in the Pali canon, as opposed to the Buddhang Saranang Gacchami, we find the Bhagavantang Saranang Gacchama Dhammancha Bhikkhu Sanghancha. It's the usual phrase. So here's the Madhura Sutta. And so the idea that, just a couple of quick notes here, the Samyukta, in this, according to the Samyukta Agama version, it seems that it suggests that the Buddha was still alive. I would say most likely because of the start says the Buddha was staying in Savatthi, but because that's just a standard beginning for a sutta, then that's not particularly significant. It's just an normal editorial position, so probably the Pali is more reliable here. Whether the king would have travelled 1500 k's to see the Buddha is not found in the Samyukta Agama version.
Various examples of the way people related to taking refuge after the Buddha died.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
That's quite a
poor
question.
Oh yeah. That sense of continuity. Yeah. What are you going to do now? Yeah. Yeah. Exactly.
Yeah. Actually, we might sort of really help you with that question.
Okay.
Because the current staff is about how do you relate to the summit, particularly when you take refuge in the summits. And if the Buddha's gone, do you need to raise up the Sangha in order to replace the Buddha. But even in such a year, which may be a nice example of, you know, how to take refuge if the Buddha's dead, China's saying don't take refuge in the Sangha first, still take refuge in the Buddha first, even when he's gone. And what that actually means though is he needs to take refuge in the Dhamma that he taught, and he needs to be educated in the Dhamma that he taught. And you probably need to go to the same effort as that king is willing to go to in order to serve the Buddha, in order to educate the Dhamma.
Another good example is not gone. The Buddha passes on, another good example remains. There is no good role model.
Yeah.
And someone who showed the full way.
Yeah.
So whether as long as it's recorded and carried through this story. And that's one way. Another is just meditate on Kalinibana, you know. Sort of like refuge in that direction.
Was it up to me and truly was it most of up the Buddha says that if you remember Kimbala Ravatara or Buddha, the country members in the world, the clan members in the world, and it's for goodness, they would for a very long time. Trying to say is that so we have the Sangha in the present, we know them and they're imperfect, and the faith faculty wants to make them perfect. But in a way, for me, it's just as an individual, that need to feel something human that was perfect at the same time is quite well satisfied by just imagining a Buddha. He's not the Buddha. But he's an Arahant. And it's just that faith I can be able to believe that a person can be an Arahant, even though. You know, the reality of our life is to see all sorts of figures of all sorts of levels. And faculty is that's the juiciness is still able to be alive because they can read Sutta and believe that.
Wait, this Sutta, I think this made me feel really sad in myself. I was looking back into his story and it just made me reflect on the human conceit, you know, how he justified this kind of caste and exploitation. And the same thing now is still happening towards animals, to the human conceit of superior, which really clouds the mind and clouds the heart and justifies this basically exploitation.
Not even animals. I mean, with the situation with women in the Sangha is exactly the same. I mean, the ethical issues are identical. You apply exactly the same ethical arguments as used by Gautama here. You know, if a woman keeps the 10 precepts, does she go to heaven or hell? You know, what's the difference? Is there any difference between a man or a woman in any of those cases? Well, no, there's no difference. And yet, it seems that it's so difficult to make such an elementary inference. You know, it's so hard for so many people to make. You know, and they say, if you're then talking about the equality of women and the study of equality, and then we're told that we were discussing the other day about Venerable Punadamo's argument that equality is somehow a Western Enlightenment idea. But here we have the very word for that they've used constantly through here is sama sama, right, which it means exactly equality. You know, are these same? Or not. You know? So this is the value of equality. I mean, the phrasing of it is used slightly differently, but it's exactly the same. We've had the explicit arguments in the case of the caste system, and unfortunately not so many explicit arguments in the case of men and women, although they do exist. But it seems so hard to make that inference. I mean, in some ways, I'm for myself, I feel... It's almost like we're going backwards so much. Like when I was at university, the example that you were bringing up now was one of the major ethical issues, and Peter Singer's idea of speciesism, and you know we should be extending our moral concern regardless of species, and you know the question should we extend our moral concern to women was not even a question, you know it's not even an issue, you know I mean obviously in practical terms and social concerns, it's still an issue, and equality is still very far in social circumstances, but it's not a theoretical issue. It seems we're just going so far backwards, worrying about these things which are really so simple.
And there's always that it's like in states that maybe are forced to conservative to rather than to react against the fees. So the excesses of that mean for that's the back of the
book, right? Oh yeah, yeah.
Yeah, and you come from a religious family like me, where it didn't occur to me there was any prejudice against women. We were four girls. And I see this as sort of, I guess I wasn't conditioning. So obviously women are equal to men. And so many struggles that I've sad.
Very sad, yeah. Mm-hmm. Sad waste of energy and waste of time. Shiva Pindabhata Senasana Gilana Pachaya Vesadya Parikara. Tiva as the rogue, Bindabhata as the alms food, Senasana is the dwelling place, and Gilanapachaya Behisadja Parikara is the medicinal requisites for the sick. So this is kind of a long compound because it's a standard list, it tends to become compounded. And this is the kind of the simplest form of compounds called a dwanda, which means that it's basically a list. So you could dwanda compounds you can replace by a list of separate words. So you could do this to it, have them separate words, and it would have the same meaning. And one of the things you can see is that even several of the actual words are themselves compounds. So pindabhata is like the dropping of lumps. Or lump dropping, and senasana is sena is the sleeping, and the asana is the sitting place. So literally, a sleeping and sitting place. And then this one again being a fairly long compound. Sik, gilana is sik, pachaya is support, medicine is the besaja is a medicine, and parikara is the requisite. So medicinal requisites for the support of the sick. And also just should just mention just in passing that this that particular passage mentions the basic Raja Dhamma, the royal duties regarding the summoners and the religious persons in the society, that they should provide as well as providing the requisites for them, but also provide lawful guarding, defence and protection. Okay, Rakhavarana Gutting. Okay, so this being important is that this is the kind of the normal value of an ancient Indian society, and that at this stage he wasn't a Buddhist, and that's what kings did, and it seems that most of the time they actually did keep that. So they did actually follow that practice. There's very little evidence of religious persecution in ancient India, and that has nothing to do with the particular sect that you belong to. Okay, so he's merely saying that he's going to protect and support all the religious people in his realm. He's not saying I'm going to support the Buddhists but not the Jains, or I'm going to support the Brahmins but not the Samanas, or something like that. And he'll support all of them.
So
let's
say about King Kutama.
That's one of the things, yeah, that's one of the aspects of the what they call Raja Dhamma. Yeah, the Raja Dhamma being the royal duties, and that being one of them, yeah. There's another term that they also use for that, being Katiya Dhamma. Normally Katiya and Raja are used as synonyms, or very closely, but Katiya Dhamma is used in a different sense, and Katiya or Kshatriya Dharma is in the sense of the rule of force. So it has a different kind of idiom, but the Kshatriya Dharma means basically we put the weapons and we're going to do it to you. Machiavellian kind of. Yeah. So this, I mean, this, it's interesting to notice this because it's essentially the same sense of duty which a modern secular state has towards the religions within it. And so this is why I think this is very important to notice this, that when we come from Buddhist countries like Thailand and so on, Sri Lanka, where there's a special relationship between the government and the religion, and the nation state identifies itself as a Buddhist nation state, is quite different from a situation in ancient India. And the situation in ancient India is actually much more similar to our situation in Australia and other places, where the government has a general policy to support the religious organisations and provide defence and security and so on, tax exemption, whatever it might be, exemption from council rates or the other blessings which the government bestows on us from time to time. And that's not dependent on one particular religion or another, but all the religions are more or less treated equally. All right, so let's finish up by paying respects.
Patipanno